say welcome back to Red Ice Radio, everyone. This is Henrik Palmgren. You can hear us worldwide through redicecreations.com. Thank you for joining us today as we proceed our investigations. John Rappaport is an investigative journalist, author, and publisher of the website nomorefakenews.com. He has worked as an investigative reporter for 30 years, writing articles on politics, medicine, and health. Although his main focus over these years has been the power of the imagination and creativity, he is most often cited and interviewed on conspiracies and global elites. Today, we're going to discuss John's take on the surveillance state, the U.S. internal agencies war, and the creation of a single universal mind. And thanks for coming on, John. You did a great interview with Lana earlier in May here. It was a really good one, and so we're very happy that you're back with us here on Red Ice Radio this time. So thank you for taking some time off, John, talking with us today.
It's great to be here, and I had a lot of good feedback from the prior interview, so I'm looking forward to this one as well.
Very good. Yeah, some good stuff came out of that one, and I think it's going to bridge a little bit as well, what we're going to get into later here as well with some of the implications of where the surveillance state is going and some of your conclusions. You have some really fascinating ideas that we'll get into, but one of the main topics, of course, we're going to try to stick to today is NSA, Edward Snowden, kind of the bigger agenda of what's going on here. When the first couple of articles I read, John, from you, I think coming out, it was a little bit of kind of an interesting point in terms of that the initial attempt to cover up or you know, kind of hide Ed Snowden, if you will, is something that kind of changed a little bit. I think in a lot of the alternative press, if you will, that they've been looking at Edward Snowden maybe a little bit different in the last few weeks or so. And initially, everyone was glad that this was coming out, of course. But what has been your position since you learned about this, the NSA scandal, Edward Snowden, and basically this cat and mouse chase that's been going on in the media in the open right now?
Well, let's see. When I first read the article in The Guardian about Snowden, you know, my detector immediately went into action and I began to wonder how real this was in terms of Snowden's story. Of course, on the other hand, anybody who exposes the NSA or any intelligence agency's illegal activities, that's fine. Great. You know, there are people who already know about these things. Many people do. None of Snowden's revelations then or now have come as a shock or a surprise in any way. But for the general public, sure, okay, fine. We have some revelations. We'll see what comes of this. I have very serious doubts whether it's going to impede the surveillance state in any way. And I see by the polls that have been taken, whether they're real or faked, that there is no clear-cut, huge siding by the American people for Snowden and against the NSA. But that's that part of it. But then Snowden's story just seemed to have holes in it. You know, questions that I would have wanted to settle with him if I were the reporter at that time. I would have asked many, many questions. For example, he says that at an early age he enlisted in the Army and became part of a special forces training program. Well, I have to assume that, you know, here's a guy at whatever he was, 19, has no high school diploma, has no, at least as far as I can tell, any superior physical skills, but he somehow gets into this training program. At what point does that occur after he joins the Army? I mean, is it the next day? Is it after 6 months? Did he display some extraordinary physical ability? My take on it is, of course not. He's a computer guy, so they need computer people, and he's supposedly a whiz at computers.
Yep.
But then he breaks both legs in a training exercise, and then he's discharged from the Army. Why? I mean, if they brought him in there to do computer work, as I said in my article, most recent article, what's the problem? Did they then say, well, look, you know, Ed, we knew you were a genius, but now that you've broken both legs, we just don't have any more faith in your ability to do computer hacking or whatever it is, and therefore, why not try to get a job at Walmart or something? We're going to discharge you from the Army. It just seems absurd, you know. So that was one of the first things that, I don't know. Then he goes to work as a security guard for NSA in around 2003 at the University of Maryland, an NSA facility. Is that just some sort of an accident, or he read an ad in the paper, he wanted to be a security guard, and turned out it was NSA, or what? Then all of a sudden, no, he's in the CIA now. Boom. He's in IT. Still no high school diploma, or maybe he's got a GED, but he's some sort of genius. So in 2007, he goes to Geneva under assignment from the CIA. He's in the CIA. He's 23 years old. And they give him diplomatic cover there, which is a big deal. I mean, he's now operating as a covert CIA agent, monitoring or maintaining computer network security, which is, you know, a pretty significant job. Now, then he says, though, that during this period in Geneva, one of the major incidents that sours him on the CIA is what he called the turning of a Swiss banker, where some CIA buddies of this banker one night encouraged him to get drunk, the banker, which he did. They encouraged him to drive home, which he did. He got arrested. Then they, you know, somehow got him out of it, and they formed a bond with it, with him, the banker, and eventually the banker began delivering secrets to the CIA. And apparently Snowden was deeply shocked and saddened by this, and that was one of the key incidents that soured him on the CIA. Well, to me, that's, you know, unbelievable. The guy knows he's in the CIA. He knows what the CIA does. This incident he takes as being a turning point, you know, and it goes on from there. I mean, I could go on for another half hour or hour with chinks in the story, places where I just don't believe what he's saying. And then also the NSA's response to Snowden seems preposterous to me in terms of what they're not able to do. They can't find him. They can't figure out what data he's taken. And the fact, and this, I'll conclude, you know, my opening salvo with this, but the idea here that we're supposed to believe is that the NSA gives people like Snowden, whether you call him a systems analyst or an analyst supervisor or a super user, which is now a new term they've introduced to the press, we're supposed to believe that they give Snowden and others like him in his similar positions complete access to the whole farm, the Holy Grail, everything all the way up and down the line. They don't compartmentalize anything for these people. They don't say this guy gets access to that and this guy to this to protect our security. No. They just give each one of these people the whole shooting match so that, as Snowden claims, he could take down the entire intelligence community of the United States in a single afternoon.
Right.
That, to me, is, you know, just absurd. So these are some of the holes that I began to immediately see in his story.
Yeah, that's right. And you go on to in your article as well, write about in 2009, he leaves the CIA, go to work for the private sector, Dell, Booz Allen Hamilton, and then later on he goes to work for NSA, and you say that, you know, basically he's an outsider. He comes fairly late, if you will, onto the scene of getting into the NSA. What do you think his clearance is at this stage? What level is he at? If he, you know, as you say, if he has all these access to the you know, the inner secrets of the NSA, how far could he have gotten in that period?
Well, he would have had to have the highest clearance possible if we accept his story about stealing the farm completely and walking off with it on three laptops. So whatever they call that, you know, I don't know the exact designation, but I just don't buy that story. I just don't think that he or anybody in his position would have that level of, you know, just total access, total exposure. I mean, this isn't like, you know, Ford Motor Company or IBM even, or a pharmaceutical company. This is supposed to be the most smart, the most heinous, the most secure and genius security agency in the world. And yet we're supposed to believe that somehow they just forgot to do good internal security on their own employees and to structure their jobs in such a way that they would only have limited access to classified material. I mean, you know, how do we come to this conclusion? And now, you know, they've said, oh yeah, we made a mistake and we're going to correct it with better internal security procedures so this can't happen again. No. I mean, the first job of an agency like that, which is spying on everybody all the time and has an architecture or a system of doing that, many interlocking systems, is how do we protect not only what we're compiling on everybody in our spying, but how do we protect the systems that we're using to spy on everybody so that nobody can get access to that, including our own employees? I mean, that would be the first question that would be raised years, decades ago, and it would be a constantly updated element in the NSA. But yet we're supposed to believe that, no, this guy brought in the thumb drive one day or whatever it was, 2 days, 3 days, and gee, we just can't defeat a thumb drive. He plugged in, he took everything, and he walked out. No, I don't believe that for a second. So that led me to, okay, this is another kind of operation here. Regardless of whether you think, you know, it's important that he exposed all this information, it's a different kind of operation.
Yep. I think you're right. I think you're onto something here. We'll get deeper into this, of course. A couple of questions before we move on here. Do you think that he's an invented character, considering maybe how little we know in terms of his background and maybe some of the potential holes in it? What do you make of it?
Well, I think he exists, but who he is and who he's actually working for, these are questions that need to be explored, which, you know, I have. And I proposed, a theory, a hypothesis as to who he really is. So in a loose sense, I'd say the answer to your question is yes, he isn't the person we think he is. He's somebody else.
Yeah.
And who that person is could be a dupe. It could be somebody who actually has the, what would we call it, pro-patriotic, pro-libertarian sentiments that he's expressed, and yet without his knowing it, he's actually been working for somebody else, or he's a conscious agent working for somebody else, not the NSA and not Booz Allen.
Yeah, and maybe allowed to do what he has done, or as you say, has been encouraged to do it in some way. But what I found interesting as well, John, is that it's always interesting to watch the reaction from the media and how they are allowed to deal with this as well. Again, this has been turned into a cat and mouse chase, and some, you know, channels are watching this like some kind of global spy game, almost right there in the open in the press. But there are other whistleblowers and people who speak out who haven't gotten at all the same level of, attention. See, Bill Edmonds, Susan Lindauer, Russ Tice, Bill Binney. There's a number of these, and some of them are from NSA as well. So my question was, why this guy? And okay, I mean, it could just be an accident. It could just be that for some reason, this is, the unseen media, conglomerate just basically picks up on this and decides to run with it, I guess, but there certainly have been others, but this one has gotten a tremendous amount of attention for some very interesting reason.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Russ Tice is a major one. I mean, this guy blew the whistle on some, highly significant stuff, including the fact that Obama was being spied on back as far as 2004 by NSA. Yeah. The media is spinning the story as, you know, it's almost like, you know, the white Bronco of O.J. Simpson going down the freeway, and everybody's focused on that. And then you've got the fact that all these veteran reporters are ignoring the obvious question. They're not being permitted to cover the story. For example, to go in there and say to NSA, look, we have doubts about what Snowden, who Snowden is, and what you are doing. And so in order to, you know, allay our suspicions, we want to know what kind of a security operation are you guys running that costs the taxpayer, you know, over $1 trillion. We're not asking for specifics, but come on. Do you really expect us to believe that all this time you failed to implement internal security measures when you're the most secure agency in the world? So you got to give us something here, or we're going to slam you up against the wall. But this is not happening. I mean, from my experience as a reporter and talking to many reporters over the years, if you let reporters off the hook and say to them, you know, we're letting the hounds loose on this story, go out there and get it, you know, which rarely happens, by the way. But if you do that, there are reporters out there who tend to wake up. Not all of them, but at least a few of them would go out there. And they would start to dig, and they would find out stuff that would make your hair curl. But they're not being permitted to do this kind of thing now. So you know the story's being spun, it's being controlled, it's being shaped, and vital details are being omitted.
The war on journalism that, you know, Obama seems to have started, and all the spying on reporters, I mean, and I just throw that in there. What happened to Michael Hastings? So,
yeah, exactly. What happened there? Exactly. And why isn't, you know, in the Michael Hastings case, you would think it's like, you know, a cop killer gets special attention from cops in the investigation and the hunt.
Yeah.
So you would think, if you were naive, well, a reporter whose death is described in a highly doubtful way looks like he was murdered. Where are the reporters who are so pissed off that they're going to go out there and find the answer to the story no matter what? They're not there.
Yeah, it's true. I think the Young Turks did one of the best jobs of following up on some of the eyewitnesses and you know, uploading that to YouTube so people could actually get an idea of what happened. But there's been an incredible silence after that. I mean, considering what a, you know, what Michael Hastings did in exposing McChrystal and some of the other people he was allegedly going after and working on a big story, like, you know, his military friend was talking about, I forget his name right now, but he talked that he had, you know, some big stories on the go. And it's just there, another story with so many holes in it, and just people are dropping it, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, where's Rolling Stone? I mean, maybe they're preparing a blockbuster article on this, but so far, I've seen absolutely nothing. I mean, he wrote for them. He was their guy.
Yeah.
You would think they would send, you know, somebody out there and say, find out what happened, and we're going to print it and put it on the cover. You know, we're not going to screw around with this. But so far, I see nothing. So, yeah, this happens all the time in media. I'm used to it. I see it. Now we've got Cheryl Atkinson, who's one of the only real investigative reporters working in major media anywhere in America, and her computer's been hacked at work and at home for, it seems like, at least a year, maybe more. She's come out and said that. CBS has admitted it. What's going on there? Well, I can go back and list the stories that she's covered, Fast and Furious, the CDC lying through their teeth about trying to create this you know, horrendous pandemic called swine flu, when that was all just total bullshit. And she nailed it. I've nailed it. Other reporters have nailed it. You know, she's covered a few serious breaking stories, and then she's been stopped. and her computer's been hacked. So why isn't this a gigantic story in the media? So, you know, there's all sorts of clues that obviously point to the fact that there's no reason to why we should believe what the major media are telling us about Snowden or the way that they're slanting the story. Why should we believe that? And so in my latest article, right at the top, I say, and we'll here quote myself, if you absolutely must have a hero, watch Superman movies. If your need for a hero is so great, so cloying, so heavy, so juicy that it swamps your curiosity, don't read this. If you can't separate Snowden's minor revelations from the question of who he is, if you can't entertain the notion that covert ops and intelligence agency games are reeking with cover stories, false trails, and limited hangouts, you need more fun in your life. You know, then I say, NSA, CIA, these guys live for high-level bullshit. They get down on their knees and worship it. They fall into a suicidal funk if they aren't lying on at least three or four levels at once. So, why should we believe these people? There's no reason under the sun why we should take their story. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of pushback on these articles I've been writing about Snowden. And one of the key elements at work in the people who are pushing back is, when you translate it, they've got to have a hero. And Snowden is their guy.
Yeah.
And that's all they care about, period. And then secondarily, they are trying to push back on the idea that I should somehow be emphasizing Snowden's revelations and not looking into his character or who he actually is. Whereas time and time again, I've talked about revelations of and deeper revelations about the NSA. So it's not that I'm trying to, you know, let the NSA off the hook, far from it. But these people just can't see it. They're blinded. They've got to have a poster boy and a hero. And if the media gives that to them, even if the media at the same time are saying, well, maybe this guy should be brought back here and put on trial, that's good enough. They've got their hero. That's the end of the story. And that's a deep psychological fact about people that is, you know, one of the major things that's playing into all of this, Snowden, NSA, all of that, is this absolute desperate need for a hero. And the slightest glimpse of a possibility that they may have found one suddenly makes them into true believers. Same deal with Obama. Same deal with George Bush for Republicans when he was elected. And same deal for Clinton. You can just take it all the way back. It's always the same. It's the hero game.
Yep.
And then the disillusionment, and then when you have to have a new one, give us a new one, please. We're desperate. We need hope. You don't need hope. You need action. You need the truth. You need to go to the truth and take that truth wherever it leads you. That's what you need. This hope hero game is ultimately self-destructive at the core of what an individual is. Individual who's free, independent, and powerful does not need some hero to put up on a pedestal every day. Yes, you can have people that you admire and respect and even love, but you take the clue from them and then you do it your own way. This whole thing of standing back and, you know, let's all salute Snowden, that's just a bunch of senseless nonsense.
Well, it's religious in a way. I mean, and people love the heroes that we're given, and this is the climate we're in now, though. I think the reformation, if you will, of society through these sanctioned leaks, as I call it, which I believe is for political purposes down the line. And I think we always should question, you know, the heroes. And again, it's not that what Snowden has brought to our attention, it's not that that's not important, just as you say. Considering what we do know about the NSA, you know, the budgets they've been given, the new data center that they've been building up in Utah and Bluffdale there, it's like, you know, 1 million to 1.5 million square feet It's costs of $1.5 billion to $2 billion when it's going to be finished now in September 2013. This is what they're doing. This is what it's about. How can this be, if you will, a surprise to people?
Exactly. And there's 30,000 people working at Fort Meade right now.
That's right. NSA. Yep.
You know, so does that give you some clue as to the ominous nature of the organization? Absolutely. Absolutely. It does nothing that he said comes as a major surprise. And as you pointed out earlier, there are other much more serious NSA whistleblowers who have, if their stories were blown up by the press in the same way that Snowden's is, then we might really have something then.
Yeah, might be getting somewhere. So let's talk about Snowden a little bit more here of who you believe he is working for, knowingly or not. What is the likely scenario here?
Okay. He claims that while he was working for the CIA in Geneva in 2008, that he could do very heavy damage to the entire U.S. intelligence community at that point. Another fact that I seriously doubt. The U.S. intelligence community is far larger than what he would have had access to in Geneva working computer security there in 2008. But, he says, he held off because he thought that maybe Obama would bring real transparency to government, and then, of course, he was disillusioned. So, in 2009, he leaves the CIA and goes to work in the private sector, Dell, Booz Allen, Hamilton, and then eventually he's assigned to work at the NSA by Booz Allen. You know, the NSA does, of course, accept many private contractors because they have so many jobs to fill.
Yep.
But to me, because the story of how he was able to so easily walk out of the NSA with all of this information because of a thumb drive and then leave the country without being surveilled, and that they had all this difficulty, they couldn't track him in Hong Kong. Of course, he could do interviews with The Guardian, no problem, but NSA just couldn't find him, et cetera, all of this nonsense. They couldn't figure out what he had on the laptops and all of this. My conclusion was he didn't do it. He didn't access all that information himself. He certainly did not access enough to, quote, take down the entire U.S. intelligence community in one afternoon. Instead, he was given access to documents that he could then use to take down the NSA a notch or two. And who would have wanted to do that? Well, there are many people who would want to do that. But the nearest and closest is his former employer, the CIA, who've been in a turf war forever with NSA because of funding, because intelligence now in this modern age has swung completely over from human intelligence, which was the territory of the CIA, to what's called signals intelligence or electronic snooping and spying. Massive. And in that arena, the CIA simply can't match NSA. And the boys at the CIA do not like this at all. We're talking about interagency warfare at a very significant level. These people are not simply working for the greater good. All governments of major size have huge interagency, relational warfare that goes on, and it's notorious between the CIA and the NSA. And recently, as James Bamford pointed out, billions of dollars in federal funding were shifted away from the CIA to NSA. So, boys at the CIA at some point contact Snowden. maybe a casual conversation. They begin to vet him, maybe while he's in Geneva. This is a long-term operation. The CIA is looking for a guy. They want a guy who's true blue, who has patriotic sentiments, who wants to see America, restored in some way and not fail, not go down the road of fascism. These are very easy conversations to have. You know, Ed, we think you're a guy that thinks the way we do. We don't like what NSA is doing. They're not just out to stop terrorism. They're spying on everybody all the time, and it's horrendous, and it's creating a new kind of reality that the people of America really just don't grasp. They don't get how far this is going to create a fascist spy state. And we're looking to do something about it. We're looking for a guy, and we think you might be interested in this. And, you know, one conversation after another, casual, and eventually they vet this guy and they think, okay, we got somebody here. Mm. Are you our guy, Ed? Yes, I am. Anything I can do to help? And so the CIA puts these documents, these NSA documents, in Snowden's hands. They protect themselves in that way because he's now working for NSA. So it looks to all who are watching that he was a defector from NSA who walked away with all this information. The CIA is not implicated in any fashion at all. And the NSA comes under greater scrutiny and attack from certain quarters. Now, there's always risks in operations like this. And the major risk is it going to succeed? Is NSA really going to be weakened in any way, or is it actually going to get stronger? But, you know, operations are mounted all the time. Some are more successful than others.
Yeah.
So my theory is that that's who Snowden is. He's still working for the CIA. They gave him the documents. He left with the documents. He may have the greatest libertarian pro-patriot sentiments, but that's who he is. And why is that important? Because it gives you some sense of how successful or unsuccessful this operation is really going to be in curtailing the surveillance state.
Very interesting. So this turf war then between the NSA and the CIA, do you think that the benefit to the CIA outweigh the risks? I mean, because at the same time, then there is a possibility that the, you know, understandably, the American people are also turning against. Because, I mean, this is also, I mean, the government funds all these, ultimately feeds all these agencies and everything else. And it's turning the American people against the government specifically. I mean, certainly NSA is more in the target than CIA. But, do you think they would play it that openly, a war like that?
I do. Because I don't think that these people always have the greater good in mind, or whatever they define as the greater good. When you get into a war with somebody, you don't always think clearly. Cooler heads don't always prevail, as we've seen, if you just read human history.
Yeah.
So you could say to somebody in the CIA, you know, here's an invented conversation. What do you guys think you're doing? Are you crazy? You're going to go to war against the NSA and use this guy Snowden? Do you really think that that's going to not blow back on you, for example, and the rest of the surveillance state and the whole federal government, which you are protecting, et cetera, et cetera? And the answer is, don't bother me. I'm making war. Because people don't always think clearly. They don't always succeed in what they're trying to do. And that's how you can get an operation like this that may blow back on them, possibly, in some indirect way.
Yeah,
I think they'll be able to protect themselves from, you know, the kind of revelation that I'm talking about, that Snowden is still working for them. But as you point out, in the long run, this could rebound against everybody in the intelligence community. But they don't care because they're pissed off, and they've been pissed off for a very long time. It's just like, ethnic warfare. you can stand there and talk to the leaders and say, has it ever occurred to you over the last 1,500 years that you're just destroying each other? And, you know, that this will never end. And they say, don't bother us. You know, we're killing each other.
And let's face it as well, the CIA doesn't have the best image, I believe, in the American people's eyes or in the world's eyes, most definitely. I mean, you can just have a peripheral little bit of an understanding of the geopolitics and, you know, borderline conspiracy to realize that, you know, how much the CIA is behind and in a way even claims to be behind. So maybe it's like a situation where they don't have anything to lose anymore.
Yes, or it's a situation where they're saying, if we go down, we take some other people down with us. Hmm. And we are going down in terms of the PR warfare. We have a bad reputation, and we don't like that. And, you know, the people that we are at war with, we're inside the government, the NSA, they're getting let off the hook, and we're not going to keep letting that happen. You know?
Hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way people often think, and you can see, any of us can see in our own experience on a very minor scale examples of that. You know, when you were going to school and there was some idiot in the class who, you know, had a very bad reputation. So who did he go after? The best student in the class. It was like, well, I'm screwed, so I'm taking this guy down any way I can. I don't want to see anybody be the star student in the class. I don't want to see any spying agency that has the kind of, you know, inviolability that the NSA has. So we're going to take them down a peg or two.
It's incredible to think about it this way, that these, you know, major agencies are fighting for each other this way. You'd think that the nation, if you will, the country of America would be their prime directive, but that's a long past dream, I guess, in terms of, you know, being interested in national sovereignty and stuff like that. These guys are into world government at this stage, and they don't care. I guess that one of their interests might be that they want to try to take over some of this budget as well, because if we just pull that quote again that you had from James Bamford in one of your latest articles, it says, in April, as part of its 2014 budget request, the Pentagon, which rules the NSA, asked Congress for $4.7 billion for increased cyberspace operations, nearly $1 billion more than the 2013 allocation. At the same time, budgets for the CIA and other intelligence agencies were cut by almost the same amount, $4.4 billion. A portion of the money going to NSA will be used to create 13 cyber attack teams. So they're on the losing end of this. That's what that is about. And yeah, it's a really interesting point.
Well, just to expand a little bit on this, I am quite sure that within the NSA and the CIA, there are honorable people. And you could say that they are misguided, but yet honorable. You could say that some of them actually are just plain old honorable, and they do in fact stop certain bad things from happening. Sure, but we're talking about monster agencies here with huge numbers of people and billions in funding, and who knows what else they're doing on the side to line their pockets. And so how policy, secret internal policy, is formed and shaped over years of this interrelational interagency warfare is just another matter entirely separate from that. And it does take place. And yes, you're right. Many of these people have already sold out completely to the globalist vision, so they don't really care what happens to America. And if you want a kind of mirror image for this, just look at Congress. I mean, they're supposed to be representatives of the people. So what happened to that?
Right.
What happened when, you know, you are a Democrat congressman sitting in your office, and into your office comes, you know, one of the leaders of the party in Congress and says, here's the bill that's coming up for a vote later this afternoon, and this is how you're going to vote on it. and you say, it's 2,500 pages long. I haven't even had a chance to read it yet. And the reply is, so what? This is how you're going to vote.
Yeah.
And you do. Well, that tells you, you know, volumes about where real patriotism has gone inside the government.
Yeah, and it's the same thing in the European Parliament. Let me tell you, there are so many of these green politicians come in there and they're getting wined and dined and they have no idea what's going on. And there's these huge stacks of reports, you know, like in the tens of thousands of pages in some cases. And they just look around and like find someone that they, and I've heard stories about this, people within Parliament are like, they're looking around trying to find someone who they trust have seen before to just visually see how they vote, and they just follow because they have no idea what they're doing. You know,
that's how it works. You bet. You bet that's how it works. And if you start to add up, you know, in the European Union, as I'm sure you know better than I, the numbers of actual regulations and rules laws and so forth that are constantly being put on the books unknown to the populations of the countries involved, It's so staggering that you can barely even believe it, but they're just turning them out like a machine every hour of every day.
I think it was, and I think this is an old statistics, I had this, but it's called a Eurlex, the law for the European Union. I think it was over 10,000 pages of different, you know, and the most weirdest, bizarre things you can imagine, like the angle of a cucumber, and this is, you know,
there you go.
It's just the most ridiculous thing, and I could go on and on forever and adding examples to this, but yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So what we're looking at here then is, you know, a completely different picture of the story than is being presented in the press. The press is, on one level, dedicated to the good guy, bad guy scenario where you pick your side and you go with it and you have defenders of Snowden and people who are attacking him. You can tune into MSNBC and you'll find that the very same people who would have been calling for George Bush's impeachment had these revelations, in quotes, about the NSA come out while he was president, are now defending Obama to the hilt.
Yeah.
Yes, we need the spying, absolutely. It's a war on terrorism, and yes, we have to fight it. We need more drones. We need more attacks. We need more death. Sure. Doesn't matter. Only matters whose side you're on, and in this choice, you then enter into the game of, I am a PR agent for this archetypal story that's going to be played a million different ways with different characters in the press, good guy versus bad guy. Who's a good guy? Who's a bad guy? Who's the hero? Who's the villain? Who's on the right side? Who's on the wrong side? Who's a Democrat? Who's a Republican? Who's a liberal? Who's a conservative? And this is the whipsaw that keeps the entranced television audience in the game. The game that the corporatocracy, the government, the globalists, the elites want people to be hypnotized by 24 hours a day. This is what we want the hypnotic trance to look like, and we want you to be part of it. And here is your television set. Now you're in. And you will hear this lame story played out over and over again, and it will key certain centers in your psyche, certain very simplistic kind of childish fairy tale centers of acceptance, and then you will become part and parcel of this stage play that we call the news, that we call information, that we call the truth. And you will be so subjected to it that the very thought that Snowden is not a hero will enrage you to the highest degree. Or if you are entranced on the other side, the very thought that he is a hero will enrage you to the skies. And now you're trapped. Now you are captured. now you are there where we want you, and you will experience a certain sequence of emotions in this particular kind of trance, and you will play those out. And when you play out that particular sequence of feelings, we'll have a new story for you that will put you back at the beginning so that you then play out the sequence again. And it's always unsatisfying. It never leads you to a place where you really genuinely feel that you have won anything, but you're so addicted now that you need another story, and we will give it to you and put you back at the beginning, and you'll just continue to do that, you know.
Yeah.
That's the game. That's the way the game is played.
Well, that's a very good point. It's the controlled Hegelian dialectic keeping you within the confines, and despite, though, that we, you know, might think that we're getting outside of it, because one thing that goes with leaks and insiders and whistleblowers and everything else has the tendency to basically get people to drop their guard or even their firewall, if you will, to do another analogy of critical thinking, because they think, oh my God, this is really from the inside, you know, because in many regards, people know today that they know that politicians lie. They know that it's all bullshit in the world, you know, or in the news and everything else. And they know that, with an increasing audience of people are looking for the alternative as well. You know, with alternative media is growing and everything. And I think that there is a calculative measure, if you will, by the powers that be within that structure. And they want to give, you know, us an option to fall into, another trap to basically believe, you know, yep, now we got the full story. We know it because it's coming from the inside. So it does serve, you know, many different purposes to do it this way.
That's a... You should underline that point about 500 times. That's really important. It's like saying, it's as if the elites are saying, okay, now we're going to give you a piece of, quote, alternative news, right?
Yeah.
A guy walked out of the NSA with a thumb drive who can take down the whole intelligence community in one afternoon, and he's talking, and he's running. And he's here, and he's there, and he's talking to WikiLeaks, and he's talking to Glenn Greenwald, and he's talking to her, and him, and this, and that, and he wants to go here and there, and wow. So this is sort of the processed food substitute for real alternative news. And it's a way of bringing those people in the so-called alternative community back into the mainstream. Because look, now you've got to read the New York Times, and now you've got to look at this, and now you've got to do that and watch the news, and you're getting sucked. You know, it's like I thought I was out, and then they pulled me back in. It's exactly that, you see. It's their version of alternative news, and that's why I immediately decided, okay, let's just calmly look at this guy's story. The story he's telling about himself, and let's see if there are any holes in it. And if there are enough holes, then we can infer that the story is really different. We're not getting the actual story. And so when I began to look further and deeper into this, the CIA connection, of course, jumped right out at me, and the turf war between the CIA and the NSA. But on another level that you are now bringing up, a much larger level that we're now into, this is also the way to continue to hypnotize people, even people who are sort of beginning to sit on the fence and think that maybe they want to break completely with mainstream information, to pull them back in. It's important for them, the elite media and the people they work for, to be able to do this from time to time, without, of course, changing anything significantly at all. It's a chimera. It's just the illusion of change. Because let's just follow this in the coming weeks and months, just the way we followed the swine flu, Fast and Furious, Benghazi, the IRS treatment of, you know, applicants for nonprofit status, the spying on reporters, the AP and Fox and Cheryl Atkinson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And let's just see where they really end up. Do they really end up anywhere? No, they don't end up anywhere. And that's part of my work, you know, as a journalist, to point this out to people. They don't end up anywhere. And so some people take this as a sign that I'm not on board with the whatever the standard alternative news is supposed to be.
Right.
See?
Yeah.
Because if I were, then I would be elevating Snowden to some great position in the sky. But what I'm saying is, no, you don't understand. These stories don't have an ending, don't you see? They've never had an ending. And you can go back as far as you want to in history, and you will see that. And so this is what you have to learn. This is sort of the meta level of understanding of information in the news. These stories don't have an ending, and there's a reason for that. And that's why you have to understand what mind control really is, and what hypnosis really is, and what a trance really is, in order to really get a perspective on what the news really is.
Very good points, John. You have much more to add to this, of course, and we're going to get into it here a little bit later. We're going to take a short break here at this stage, and then later we're going to get into more, you know, basically where this is going with the surveillance state and the objective beyond therefrom. But let's give out your website, and I wanted you to tell us a little bit about, you know, Exit from the Matrix and the Matrix Revealed as well before we take a break, John.
Okay, well, the site is nomorefakenews.com. I've been online now since 2001, and Exit from the Matrix and the Matrix Revealed are two mega collections that I put together over really the last 12 years, maybe more than that in terms of the information. And they are exactly what they say they are. What is the Matrix in its fullest glory? You know, what does it really look like? How is it built? The nuts and the bolts of how it's created. And without going into a long song and dance, I was able to interview, after vetting, a retired propaganda operative of significant power who decided to talk to me after he was introduced to me while I was writing my first book. And eventually we got into more than conversations, we got into interviews. He goes by the pseudonym of Ellis Medavoy, and he began to reveal to me, you know, how the world of information is really built from the point of view of a propagandist who has significant power and a tremendous amount of insight. Not back in Edward Bernays' days, but now.
Yeah.
And that's part of the Matrix Revealed. Then I formed a very significant friendship with a hypnotherapist who since died named Jack True, and interviewed him many, many, many times. And many of those interviews are included in The Matrix Revealed because we there get into levels of understanding about mind control that Jack just simply surpassed by thousands of miles any presentation of that data and what it really involves, and also the undoing of it on many different levels, not just simply trauma-based CIA mind control, but the mind control that's happening every day all around us that blinds us to the structure of the Matrix. And in Exit from the Matrix, taking off from my work with Jack many years ago, I developed many, many techniques and exercises of imagination and creativity that, if practiced in a serious way, change consciousness to the point where one really can exit from the Matrix. And so those are the two mega collections on my site. And then, you know, mostly every day, I mean, every day I'm writing articles and commenting on the news and commenting on the news about the news, trying to show people the meta levels of reality that are presented to us as being true but are actually fictitious. And this goes into many different areas, medical, political, psychiatric, media, etc., etc.
All right, very good. Great. Check out Exit from the Matrix and The Matrix Revealed over at nomorefakenews.com. Some great points here, John. We're going to continue, of course, with more after a little bit. We'll take a short break here, but stay with us. We'll be right back. Right, everybody, that's our first hour. We have much more coming up in the second, as it gets even more interesting as we begin to discuss John's suggestions on how the overt surveillance war now is going into high gear, and that this is all about creating a single universal mind with the self-censorship and the terrorist stamp being put on regular people and the creation of a monoculture. This is how they're attempting to domesticate all the individuals who are refusing to merge with the collective and go their own way. John explains that most of us is in a stimulus response operational mode, and this is how we give up most of our power by playing the game. We go much deeper in the second, and you should not miss it. We'll continue at redicemembers.com, our members website, and when you want to hear more of this or any of our previous 700 plus programs, or watch our videos, TV episodes, film special content, listen to our commentaries or music, sign up at redicemembers.com. A 3-month subscription for just €5 per month will get you full access to our archives. This is listener-supported radio. We spare you from commercial interruptions and an ad-free website. We'll be back with more shortly. James Bamford, Lennon Honor, Adrian Salbucci, Jeffrey James, Larkin Rose, and many more will be joining us. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you on the other side of this break.